24. Are we out or in? Anton Smith, who was the charge d'affaires at the United States Embassy in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, when Barack Obama was elected president, possessed a streak of independence that sometimes made it difficult for him to accept the conformity required by government service. He was a tall, lean, athletic man in his early 40s, with green-gray eyes and a flattened nose that looked as if it might have been broken in a fight or a scuba-diving accident, possibilities that would not have surprised his friends. Smith had grown up in Arkansas, where he earned a bachelor's degree in English at Henderson State University. Later, he earned a master's degree at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., as well as a second graduate degree at the U.S. Army War College, and he joined the Foreign Service. His political views were difficult to categorize, but he tended toward libertarianism and spoke favorably with friends about Representative Ron Paul, a member of Congress who did not often attract even glancing admiration from American diplomats. Smith moved through diplomatic postings in war zones such as Iraq and the Balkans. He also served for a year as a fellow on the staff of Senator Richard Shelby, a conservative Republican from Alabama who held an influential position on the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking. Although Smith had never served in Africa, his exposure to economic matters helped to qualify him for a posting in Equatorial Guinea. Malabo job openings, in any event, did not attract the swarm of internal State Department applications typical of, say, postings at the Barcelona consulate. In 2007, Smith arrived as Deputy Chief of Mission at the two-story rented concrete house that served as the U.S. Embassy in Malabo. The Ambassador, Donald C. Johnson, departed his posting before its scheduled end, leaving Anton Smith as charge d'affaires, a designation that gave him the role of ambassador without its salary or full rank. Equatorial Guinea remained a troubled country, but it was no longer the isolated, poor, malarial place that had seemed to induce occasional bouts of madness in previous generations of international diplomats. Modern hotels, housing complexes, hospitals, and freshly painted government compounds had sprung up in the tropical forests. The island capital and the mainland coast resonated with the mechanical roar of construction equipment. Internet connections were slow and bulky, but they nonetheless brought Equatoguineans into contact with worlds of information previously beyond reach. Oil-funded scholarships allowed more and more young people to study abroad. Many of the recipients were hand-picked by the regime, but Western education endowed them with new ideas. When they returned to Malabo in polo shirts and baseball caps, they formed businesses or took up positions of responsibility in government ministries. The country remained anomalous in a number of respects. Its government's failure, under Teodoro Obiang, even after the resolution of the Riggs Bank fiasco of 2004, to adhere to international banking rules meant, for example, that Equatorial Guinea had no access to credit card facilities, and therefore almost all local commerce arising from the oil boom had to be conducted in cash. Organized political opposition to Obiang remained virtually non-existent, and the president periodically tried, jailed, and executed real and imagined conspirators against him. Anton Smith took to Equatorial Guinea with a passion. Its remoteness and its lush landscapes spoke to his sense of adventure. On weekends, he dove into the Atlantic to scuba dive or snorkel or swim through the warm saltwater lagoons. He made friends with an international cocoa farmer who spent weekends on a colonial-era seaside estate. Smith would turn up on some Sunday afternoons to help cook up paellas for eclectic bands of relaxing expatriates and Equatoguineans. He spoke enthusiastically about introducing Equatorial Guinea to the international sport of bungee jumping. He met regularly with the country representatives of the big American oil companies whose operations enriched Obiang's regime, ExxonMobil, Marathon, and Hess, and he tried to support their investments and policy priorities within the country and back in Washington. He developed friendships across the local community as well. Smith's long marriage was ending when he arrived in Malabo. He fell in love with an Equatoguinean woman. She became pregnant, and they moved in together. They later married. Smith could occasionally speak about Africa in ways that struck some of his friends as misguided, but his intimate connection to a local Equatoguinean family deepened his knowledge of the country he was professionally assigned to understand. Smith was self-conscious about the possibility that he was going native, as diplomats refer to the tendency of envoys sent abroad to identify with their host countries, potentially at the expense of clarity about American interests. Yet if Anton Smith did seem, as the months passed, increasingly to resemble a character in a Graham Greene novel, this did not come at the expense of his professional devotion. He brought the same restless energy and willingness to defy convention to his role as America's principal liaison to the oil-endowed government of Equatorial Guinea as he did to the rest of his life. And the more time Smith spent in Malabo, the more he believed that American policy, its one-dimensional focus on past and present human rights abuses, its unwillingness to respond seriously to Equatorial Guinea's security needs, its reluctance to engage fully with Obiang's regime, was misguided, hypocritical, and self-defeating. Smith pointed out in sometimes heated exchanges with colleagues at State Department headquarters that since the Second World War, during its search for oil security, the United States had entered into deep alliances with Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, among other Middle Eastern oil producers. All were authoritarian states with dismal human rights records, particularly in the realms of free speech and assembly. Yet a diverse number of American presidents continually sold these regimes jets, tanks, and missiles so that they could protect their oil inheritance in an unruly neighborhood, and by doing so, assure supplies would be available to the United States. American military forces intervened directly to liberate Kuwait after Iraq's 1990 invasion, and the U.S. military provided an ongoing de facto defense of Saudi Arabia's oil fields. These geopolitical bargains had endured despite evidence that the Saudi government tolerated financial flows to violent anti-American Islamist radicals. How did the case of Equatorial Guinea measure up by comparison? Rather well, Smith argued. Its government pledged full cooperation with American foreign policy. Its oil flowed a shorter distance across safer seas to American refineries. Its political economy was unattractive, and its human rights record was poor, true. But at least Equatorial Guinea had the excuse that it had enjoyed the basis for economic modernization for only a decade. Saudi Arabia had been rolling in oil revenue since the 1960s, and it still had not liberalized its politics. Moreover, and perhaps most important in Smith's judgment, the situation in Equatorial Guinea was improving. Obiang had made heavy investments in the social sector, particularly in housing. He had accepted police training on human rights. Yet the State Department seemed congenitally unwilling to acknowledge these incremental changes and the sense of positive direction that they might suggest. In the Middle East, generations of diplomats had operated on the assumption that it was necessary to accept the limitations of Persian Gulf political economies in order to fuel America's economy with reliable, relatively cheap oil supplies. In Africa, by contrast, generations of diplomats had operated on an assumption that all that mattered were the continent's large, often intractable problems, such as disease and low-grade civil wars. When it came to setting policy priorities for Equatorial Guinea during interagency meetings at the National Security Council in Washington, human rights issues figured more heavily than they did in the cases of America's longtime Gulf allies. Saudi Arabia's oil production dwarfed Equatorial Guinea's, and the dangers of losing even unreliable allies, such as Riyadh's royal family, in a region where Iran's radical revolutionary government continued to foment upheaval, might justify the different approach Washington took in the Middle East. But the policy differences were not subjected to careful scrutiny. The assumptions undergirding America's regional foreign and defense policies had become deeply embedded.